This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat has the day off today, but we are joined by two very fascinating guests to talk about the sociology of grunge. Essentially, to look back to the 90s and the early 2000s, perhaps, in a more critical lens, to better understand the socio-political resonance of that key period of music history, and to locate it in our context as well, as consumers of music at the time. To do that with me are two very fascinating people. We have, first of all, ethnomusicologist Adil Johan. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
And you are, in addition to being a cultural theorist and academic, you're also a musician. You're a saxophonist.
Yes, I am. Yeah. But I probably would consider myself a non-conventional saxophonist, or at least I like to believe that.
Okay. Yeah. In what way are you non-conventional as a saxophone player?
I studied jazz, but now I don't play in any jazz bands, much to the disappointment of my jazz friends.
Okay. Well, who knows? Maybe you'll make a jazz return one day later down the road. You never know. Yeah. We also are joined by city councillor, former rocker and kickboxer, Shalina Rashid.
Hi. Yes, that pretty much sums up. Yeah.
Yeah. You were a member of the band Paku, which is, I guess, indie alternative rock group from the late 90s, early 2000s, right? You were a guitarist?
The band started in, we formed the band in 2004?
Oh, 2004. Yes, okay, yeah, okay. Yeah. So a little after that. Yeah. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to get your perspective as well from somebody in the industry. You lived in the States before that, and then of course you toured the UK as well. And I think you circulate in the shifting trends of globalization, and your perspective will be very, very interesting in that sense. Now, firstly, I think maybe you can help us start a discussion here, Adil, by talking about how music carries social and political resonance. That when we consume something, it's not just fun, it's not just another object at the shelf. We are also participating in certain social codes, in certain political developments. How do we understand the connection between the two?
Well, a lot of people who do study music cite Bourdieu and his idea of the politics of taste and the idea of habitus and feels of taste, where people construct meaning. So music, in a way, is a very powerful means for people to construct social meaning in terms aesthetically. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if music is very loud and racy, full of distortion, that can be a symbol of rebellion for youth, for example, because it differs from the soft, evergreen, easy listening music that their parents listening to. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, music, or at least on one level, can aesthetically define a social habitus or a social state for particular groups of people.
Right. And the interesting part about that is that how the social habitus, while beginning in a local context, say, for example, Seattle, can nonetheless resonate beyond that, right? And where does globalization play in better kind of understanding how that habitus, you know, extends itself and somehow evolves?
There's this tendency to have this idealistic vision of, for example, rock music reaching out across borders, across people from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. But I'm a bit skeptical with that notion, because we have to consider, especially in the context of globalization, the globalization of capitalism, right? And all these global flows of markets. And very much so in the 1990s, the flow of music products, of music commodities, was very much facilitated by this global neoliberal capitalism. Mm-hmm, that's how a young boy in Penang in 1997 could get hold of a cassette of Nirvana's Nevermind.
Right? That's what makes that period interesting. It was after the Cold War. At that point, capitalism was really triumphant. But it was also at the same time marketing a certain kind of rebellion, right? So when we think about grunge or that period of music, for many of us, especially in Malaysia, we saw that as an articulation of angst, as a way for us to express some of the kind of youthful aggression that we had at that time. I mean, what did it mean for you, Shalina, especially as somebody who eventually decided to go to music as well? What was that period of music and consumption? What did it symbolize for you?
I remember it was 1991, and I came back from school. This was a few months before my family and I, we moved briefly to Oregon. So this was in Penang, 1991, and I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit for the very first time on Radio 4. And I thought, wow, what is that? You know, and I, you know, an 11-year-old version of me tried to pigeonhole this type of music. It didn't seem like the what we're used to listening to. You know, back then you had, I think Guns N' Roses just released Use Your Illusions 2 as well. And I thought it was just mind-blowing because it captured this intense feeling that I had. Again, you know, 11 years old, what would I have known about life and all of that? So after that, we moved to Oregon, Eugene, Oregon. And it was a fascinating time because it was around the time when grunge exploded.
And Portland is just right next to Washington State, which is where Seattle is.
Yeah. And so it was a very interesting time for me. And just experiencing it, you know,
How about the social difference there? Because you are a person of color at a time where grunge was largely, for the most part, with exception maybe Kim Tae-il of Soundgarden or something, white. And then you're also female. Mm-hmm. While there are a lot of female bands around that time, like Veruca Salt and L7, they weren't quite the poster faces for that movement. What was that connection like with this movement, which spoke to you, to your generation, right? The teen spirit, so to speak, but at the same time, you were embodying this different identity, also as a non-American, right?
See, I didn't think of it as, you know, embracing a different identity. I mean, it looked, what I found fascinating and very inspiring was the fact that, you know, there were a lot of really talented women who were given, you know, the space to express themselves musically. And I thought that was one of the coolest things ever. Mm-hmm. And I never saw it as a matter of ethnicity or, you know, nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting thing about capitalism itself. While it alienates, it also allows room for commodification, right? So on one hand, it was the kind of crude marketing that you described earlier, Adil, but at the same time, in order to reach new markets, they had to include female audiences and they had to include female bands, right?
Of course, I mean, you can never market anything in a crude way in a neoliberal, in a neoliberal aesthetic or approach of commercializing any kind of product, and reaching to that youth demographic. I mean, you cannot give the credit to the powers of corporate capitalism when it comes to the agency of a music style like grunge. There's a very complex history to the formation of grunge, which I'm not an expert on, but I mean, that's pretty much the same with any kind of musical movement. Mm-hmm. The music, I believe anyway, started off in a very, the music of Kurt Cobain anyway, and the grunge movement, started off in a very honest and very anti-establishment kind of spirit, in that they were questioning the norms of standard American white dominant society. They were questioning male dominance and power. There was a very strong anti-sexist message behind the grunge movement. But good music, I guess, is good music. And if it appeals to youth who are experiencing a sense of alienation in that stage of capitalism or in that stage of, in that social stage in a place like the US, maybe that's what spoke to the youth at the time, right?
Yeah. I mean, I do agree with that. Now, I was just thinking about, you know, how what made grunge, especially grunge, very appealing was the fact that it spoke to, you know, the disenfranchised youth of that era. I mean, in the world of back then, you know, you had Tiffany's and Debbie Gibson's and New Kids on the Block and Vanilla Ice. And then all of a sudden you had you know, something that was just completely different. It's also quite reminiscent to how, you know, punk exploded.
Mm-hmm. Whereas punk, for example, The Clash, you know, or Sex Pistols had a sense of systemic rebellion. My sense of grunge was that it was more inward personal angst, right? I mean, you have songs like, you know, I Hate Myself and I Want to Die, right? Rather than like, you know, Anarchy in the UK, which is sort of like rebellion against, you know, a feudal kind of monarchic system on one hand, but at the same time, this sort of like rebellion against the emptiness of the self, right? So, well, yes, both, to a certain extent, all rock and roll is a kind of rebellion, but definitely grunge personalized it a bit more. Do you get that sense?
It definitely personalized it. And I mean, it created that with a very personal narrative in the lyrics, especially of Kurt Cobain. I'm not an expert on other grunge bands, but I definitely consumed a lot of Kurt Cobain growing up as an angst-ridden teenager, you know, at the age of 15 or 16. And the lyrics, when I listened to Smells Like Teen Spirit, I could sing along with it, and I could relate the kind of intricacies of the text. You know, what is my libido, my albino? What does that mean? But there is something that speaks to you personally in the poetics of that text.
Mm-hmm. You know? How was it like, Sherina, coming back then to Malaysia? And as I understand it, you were at a very interesting time when local bands were trying to adopt this style. I'm thinking, to at that time, the names that come to mind were Lime, Jason Lowe, Butterfingers, OAG, and they were embracing this new idiom of popular music and trying to localize it here. Although the interesting thing since then is that at least, you know, OAG and Butterfingers, they've used more Malay since then. I think they've mellowed to it, as artists typically do. But at that time, they were experimenting. Nobody knew what they were doing, and it seems like they said, well, let's just go with it.
Right. You know? Before I answer that question, I just want to, can I just add a little bit?
Sure.
Because you mentioned about I Hate Myself and I Want to Die, and as well as Anarchy in the UK. Two songs that pop in my head as you were mentioning that. Junkhead by Alice in Chains, as well as another one I wanted to point out. Jeremy by Pearl Jam.
Ah, yes.
So, I mean, when you mention about, you know, the songs and lyrics and contents of, you know, the grunge movement, yes, it did more than just, you know, identify or even address, you know, the personal feelings, but it also addressed situations of society and what was going on in schools. Like, we all know what Jeremy was written about. It was based on a true occurrence that happened where this kid just showed up in school one day and just opened fire. School shooting, basically.
I think, again, it was
one of the earliest reports that I remember reading, and I thought, what a horrible thing to do. And then that sparked a lot of curiosity, like what would trigger a human being, especially a kid, to commit such, you know, such horrific acts of violence.
Now that you mentioned that example, there's this famous image of, was it Eddie Vedder, who carved pro-choice in his arm at a concert. Do you remember this image?
Yes, I do remember.
Yeah. So while their identity was not ostensibly like political, they did touch on them at times. But I would also try to nuance this by saying that it's a very middle-class sort of burden by kind of materialist aspirations, kind of angst. I don't know if I'm wording this right, Adil, but
it's not just
kind of like angst, but located in a particular class position. Yeah,
you could. I mean, I would definitely say that it is the consumers of this music in the States were predominantly white and middle class, predominantly. But that's also the makeup of the States at the time. Because if you wanted to talk about more working class, non-white music in the 90s, then hip-hop and rap is music that kind of appealed to that on different levels. But it's also very, you have to nuance that as well, because Kurt Cobain was working class.
Yeah, he was a janitor,
He came from a working class background.
Homeless as well.
And you cannot discount the fact how his music can also appeal to people from different backgrounds as well.
Oh, wonderful stuff, because we have a lot of details of music history woven with theory as well to better understand it. But let's get into more discussions in the second part of the show. But for now, let's take a break. This is me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Shalina Rashid and Adil Johan. And we're discussing the sociology of grunge here on Night School at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School, and we are joined this week by Shalina Rashid, city councillor, kickboxer, and rock and roller. And of course, we have ethnomusicologist and saxophone player, Adil Johan. And we're discussing the sociology of grunge. And we got a good view of the general theoretical themes of that period of music and the kinds of issues they were trying to address. But we also know that the influence reached far and wide, even to our own country. And I mentioned this in the first half, Shalina, about how local Malaysian bands were trying to adopt that style, adopt that sound for our context. Where were you at that time? What were some of the things that you observed as well? Because you were going to do the same thing with your band, Paku.
The thing I can relate to is when, for example, Butterfingers, when they first came out with the album 1.2 milligrams. Mm-hmm. I bought the cassette back in 1996, I think, mm-hmm. and when I listened to it, it sounded cool because, number one, yeah, it did sound reminiscent to, again, you know, Nirvana. But what's beautiful about the band was that as they produced more albums, they kind of drifted apart from that original sound of trying to sound like Nirvana. And I think several critics also said a few things about, or rather commented on, the similarities. And I think for bands, you know, you try to make music that sounds good, what makes it sound good, sorry. But as you grow in a band, that's when you start to develop your own sound. Mm-hmm. And I think from my experience, being in a band in Paku, it was just basically five of us who decided, yeah, you know what? We love music. We want to play music. We want to create music. And we did that. And it was a beautiful experience. And it was after playing together for so long, then we started to experiment with different sounds. And I think, in a sense, that's where the localizing of certain sounds and elements come in.
What strikes me about that period is the use of English that we've seen sort of evolve in the local music scene. Somehow, by relating to that music, we've also related to the language that goes into that music. This, at least at face value, tells us a lot about the class here and their pattern of consumption as well. What comes to mind to you, Adil?
What comes to mind is actually a mythical anecdote about Emmett from Butterfingers that my friends often relate to me, and I apologize if this is not true, it's an anecdote, but just so happens that apparently Emmett was not very well versed in Malay. Mm. He was of mixed background. I think he was educated abroad for a long time, much like Shalina, and he spoke. He was very shy about speaking in Malay, mm-hmm. because I think he had a bad experience once, you know, mm-hmm. the typical kind of admonishments you get for being pelat and celo,
right,
things like that. And I think it does definitely relate to what we were saying earlier about maybe let's focus on Malays, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so young Malays in an increasingly globalized world, increasingly more middle class, increasingly, if not middle class, then exposed to global markets and to global entertainment, at least to arts and music.
Yeah.
That adoption of English is also a result of this globalization, because mm-hmm. I think I would assume, what my deduction would be, that the reason why English was used in early Malaysian grunge bands was because the bands, for very practical reason, because the bands were listening to English grunge, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. so they wanted to write music in English. Mm-hmm. I think that I could be wrong, but
you could make the comparison with Indonesian bands. That's always a comparison, right, in the sense that they bond with a language differently, yes, than we do. But I do want to also extend that insight about class, in that if you were a teenager interested in music in the 90s, you needed certain material comforts to in order to pursue that. You need it to buy
a Walkman.
We take it for granted today because we Spotify everything. Yes. Back then, to be into music, you needed to buy stuff.
My Walkman was my best friend, I can tell you that.
Mine too.
And I don't know about you, Shaina, but I was convinced that cassettes were the best medium for listening to and carrying music.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Because
completely convinced.
Unless it took a while for the Discman to have that anti-skip mechanism.
Yes.
Because for the longest time, if the slightest knock of the table just skip, or like the slightest movement you make will just disrupt it. But if you have the Walkman with that skip feature, I forgot what it's called, you can just press forward and just wait for a few seconds and get to the next song. And I just want to be nostalgic a bit because I teach, and sometimes my students don't know what a cassette is because they are just Spotifying.
Yes.
And I tell them about the joy of going to a record store and just getting that CD off the shelf that you've been waiting for. Yes. And the joy of like opening that package and looking at the booklet and the sleeve art, which is lost. But all this to say that the culture of consuming music at that time was just more joyous than today. I don't know if I'm just being an uncle or something, but compared to today where everything's instant, everything is just YouTube or Spotify or Pandora, the aura of music as an object has faded.
Well, I don't think it has faded. I think it has, you know, evolved. But I do get that feeling as well, you know, just being reminiscent, just remembering, you know, just going to a record store when we were young, you know, buying a cassette, that was the joyous.
Yeah.
Such a joyous occasion. And, you know, you go home and then you listen to the entire cassette. You couldn't pick and choose which songs. You had to like listen throughout the whole, both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take out the cover and then you look at the artwork. It's satisfying. But I think kids these days have a different way of appreciating music, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's something to be said about the way that we are reminiscing about this. I find this very fascinating as well. Mm. I'm sorry to be a bit meta here, but I think it also kind of reflects our position as maybe as middle-class Malays growing up in this kind of generation where our parents who were the beneficiaries of advanced NEP.
Mm-hmm.
And Fuad was mentioning this earlier in a separate discussion. We are... Maybe our generation is the generation that really benefited from the English education of our parents, which then allowed us within our social class to consume this kind of material, to then also relate to the angst, which is very much parallel the social situation in the States, for example. It's probably why we could relate so much to that kind of music.
That's a really interesting point, because you two are a bit different because you're kids of academics, you know, you grew up in the rolling hills of USM or whatever, but
it's true.
hills of USM.
But I know growing up in Shah Alam and partly in Subang that every other friend of mine has a parent who's either running a business or is part of that economy that was growing at the time. The expectation for us was to do the same practical stuff, engineering, law, degree, whatever that could put food on the table, and music serve as an outlet for that. In a separate conversation, we're talking about Matsum, right? And Matsum encapsulated that dilemma between, on one hand, the father wanting him to just follow the social script, get married, get money, right? But he was an idealist. He wanted to write. He wanted to express his inner turmoil and inner discoveries of life. This split captures the broader anxieties that everybody of the 90s milieu felt, right? Between on one hand, the crude demands of just being economically stable, being economically predictable, but on the other hand, also being human, right? And I think when you had grunge so angst-ridden, but so explosive at the same time, you had a fitting soundtrack for that.
I think it was a wonderful way to resist the dominance of crass consumer culture of the 90s. The one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is yuppie culture in the 90s. So the 90s is also characteristic of this kind of crass consumerism, Wall Street, shoulder pads, in jackets, and this kind of like go get and, you know, live capitalism to the fullest, go out and get your money. In many ways, maybe our parents' generation were running that script, right? But But grunge and the rock scene that came out of Seattle was very much a response to this kind of crass, overly consumeristic, capitalistic way of living your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's this kind of advanced more beast of American capitalism. So there had to be a counter to that.
Yep.
And grunge offered that counter narrative for the youth that were, one, had the pressure, the social pressure to conform to these norms, but at the same time, they felt very alienated from it. So in a way, grunge, I think, filled, at least the rock music of the 90s, filled that space. It gave that kind of voice to a kind of disenfranchisement of younger people.
Yeah, yeah. If you look at how grunge exploded and where it began, you know, it began in basically Seattle. You know, we're talking about rain-soaked, you know, cloudy, horrible weather. And yeah, that came from the situation that existed there, and the situation, the social situations as well.
Yeah, it wasn't New York. It wasn't Hollywood, right?
No, it was
not. Just somewhere in the West Coast, in a town that people had overlooked for the most part. And I don't know about what the fashion sense of the local grunge bands was like. I can't remember that much, but I know that at least in the States, what they showed was just jeans and t-shirts, right, and sneakers.
And I mean, also,
I don't know if
you think. Also flannel, because, you know, the weather was cold,
right,
so flannel
right.
was nice and warm, and you had, you know, Doc Martin boots because they were just practical. So the fashion was purely based on what was practical for the people there, and you know what, it looked cool, and this was what the fashion designers and fashion magazines, you know, capitalized.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, grunge became commercialized, and
you
know, that brought forth different issues.
Adil mentioned hip hop earlier, and that's a parallel development we haven't touched on.
Yeah.
But it's relevant for Malaysia because 90s also saw Poetic Ammo,
yes.
Too Fat. That we're experimenting
Shailina
with.
Is
form.
Cringing.
No, I'm not. I'm just gleefully laughing. It's great.
I was trying not to, but I think back to it rather fondly because it was a very interesting attempt, right? I mean, somebody had to start the ball rolling, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, you know, if musicians feel that, you know, they want to make the music that makes them feel good, then by all means, I mean, go ahead. Who are we to judge?
Yeah.
I find this very interesting because I'm a fan of both kinds of music. And in that, there's a tension between rap and rock in the 90s.
Hmm.
This is encapsulated in the film Empire Records.
Now,
and it was very popular and it was very influential to people who did like rock and grunge, right? And it was very white. It was a very white narrative. But of course, as when you're growing up, you don't see it that
way,
right?
Sure,
you see the quote-unquote universal appeal of, what's the name of that actor again? Anyway, so there's a very telling scene in Empire Records where a kid gets caught for shoplifting and he gets caught by the older kids who run the store and said, "What's this? You're listening to rap? Couldn't you at least steal something good?" You know, so there's this kind of admonishment of rap as this kind of crass other. But there is, I do have to nuance this again as well, because the resistance to rap was that there's this assumption that rap is very hyper-masculine, violent, and also very commercial, like very openly commercialized form of music. So that's where the tension lies. But I think we really need to reconsider the importance of music of a disenfranchised class minority group in the States that had to use that kind of narrative to reclaim, you know, some sense of cultural relevance.
And that's what makes rap's adoption in Malaysia very interesting, because while it surfaced, especially around that time when gangster rap was prominent, it surfaced out of legit disenfranchisement of a minority community. The consumption patterns were still nonetheless middle class, because that's, again, the alienation that seeks an expression. And maybe that was why it was much slower for rap to evolve locally than grunge. It feels like the rock format was already very much in movement, right? Whereas for hip-hop, it seems like it was just fits and starts, right? You had KRU, then you had For You to See, but this was the Malay sort of context. But for the middle class, who were English-speaking and more aspirational, they needed to articulate it in English. So, I don't know. I mean, my recollection is that it was less seamless than, say, the development of local rock. I mean, that's just my impression, yeah.
a friend of mine, Edry, he's a rapper.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
Not to plug it, but they've recently released a video for Bursae, and he raps, and it's great, it's wonderful. And just gonna add a little bit about rap acts that came out in the 1990s. Arrested Development.
Mm-hmm.
Not the film, not the TV show.
Yeah.
But I owned their first album, and it was good. It was well written, and it had very strong messages about social structures, social, you know, struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think one song, Mr. Wendell, addresses, you know, homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that is very rare, I feel. And we hardly see that kind of messaging in, I guess, rap music these days.
Yeah, not at the highest mainstream level. Although nowadays you have somebody like Kendrick Lamar. I mean, since the Ferguson riots, right, you've had this, it's reclaiming that sort of protest element of it. But I do think that ultimately when we look at these things, one of the things that I keep noticing is language, right? In the sense that we don't want to say that English is a foreign language. It's not, because it shapes so much of our culture
very
too.
Much so.
It's just wondering how to position it, you know, in the sense that we don't want this binary, right, between Bahasa and English, right? It's not realistic because it just doesn't reflect reality here, where English is somewhere in the vocabulary, somewhere in the scenery, somewhere in the everyday rhythm of our speech and media and stuff like that. And I think it's still early to tell, but one thing for sure is that the experiments in the 90s paved the way for a lot of the kind of developments in music that we see today. You know, that was the turning point where the urban generation today that we're a part of, that our children be a part of, began its own consumer music culture. Back to your earlier point too, Adil, about how the 90s was this outburst of neoliberalism. I have in mind Ella's album, Ella USA. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
right?
I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah,
yes,
that she played very much into that theme, right?
Yes.
Where there's something about Americanization that we just have to face and adopt. And these were the barometers for how to engage with the broader development of globalization, which is why I think we can always come back to it and find clues of how cool sensibilities reacted, you know?
That album, by the way, my brother loves it. hi, Riz. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the tracks on the album, one of the guitar tracks, the guitar solo, was actually recorded by Slash. And
wow.
Yes, I remember. I can't remember
the song, but that was actually, yeah. You can Google it. And I remember that there were a lot of local musicians who thought, who criticized that move. And they were saying, you know, it's Ella, ngapa tak ada orang lain ke? And, you know, so there's that backlash of local musicians who felt that, you know, why did she have to do that? Why did the producers feel the need to, you know, spend money to get, you know, Slash?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to have a listen to this album now. But there's always going to be this backlash.
Definitely.
Right, of this kind of, this sense of, there's a kind of defensiveness, encroachment of difference. When the irony of it all is that the difference is already adopted and embodied.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking in another show about cosmopolitanism. We were talking about also how that relates to post-colonialism. So maybe these are the kind of theoretical threads that we need to string together to kind of conceptualize this adoption of English, which is also very much internalized. Yet at the same time, there's this need to construct our own identity and safeguard that from interlopers from the other world. This is where all these ironies and paradoxes come into play, especially in music.
No, I can't agree more. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have today, though. We have to do recommendations, typically. What do you have in mind for us? Reading material, or even, since we're talking about this, maybe albums, you know, albums that can kind of help us think about this stuff.
If you haven't listened to grunge, then you have to listen to Nevermind. But also listen to Pearl Jam. I think Shalina is the one that should be recommending the music. She's the expert on grunge.
No, I wouldn't say I'm an expert, you know, but there's so many good bands out there. You know, apart from Nirvana and Pearl Jam, you know, listen to the Melvins or Mudhoney, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, so many good bands.
I won't add anything else to that. But for reading, I'm gonna thank Fuad for this, because he actually alerted me to her. She's an academic named Catherine Strong, and she wrote a book on grunge. She did her PhD on it and wrote a wonderful book on it. Mm-hmm. I believe it's called Grunge and Memory. Grunge Music and Memory.
Yep.
But for something a bit more accessible, I would read the article that she wrote, which is really interesting. It's called Grunge, Riot Girl, and the Forgetting of Women in Popular Culture. Life. And that's in the Journal of Popular Culture. And it's a really nice condensation, I think, of her work. But she also draws attention to the importance of women in the grunge movement that are very conveniently forgotten today. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I saw in all the music that we've mentioned, did we mention any female bands? Not really. Mm-hmm. I was listening to Hole, Celebrity Skin, a lot when I was into grunge. And there's a lot of controversy about Courtney Love, but... Yes. It's weird that we tend to focus on the negative aspects of Courtney Love, right? So there's something to be said about how we gender our memory about grunge as well.
What I like about her work is that she places a lot of centrality on memory and understanding music.
Yes.
Sometimes we tend to think of...
Not Courtney Love, right?
Oh, no,
Catherine
Strong. Catherine Strong, yeah, yeah. Although Courtney Love is, you know, memorable in many ways. So the idea that we don't just access these songs or these products in unmediated fashion. There's memory happening, so... How do you understand that process of recollection? She really emphasizes a lot of that. So great recommendation, Adil. So do you tweet? Is there ways that our listeners can access you and your personality, so to speak?
Okay, for me, you can find me on Facebook at Adil Johan. Mm-hmm. Just add me, but please, with the caveat of please send me a quick message so that tell me that maybe you heard me on the show. And I'll definitely confirm you as a friend. And I don't tweet, but I am on YouTube.
Okay.
Because a lot of my research work on Malay film music is on there. So just search for Adil Johan channel on YouTube and you'll find me.
Okay. I'm on Twitter, Sherlena, SYERLEENA, as well as Facebook, Sherlena Abdulrashid. But those are purely political, so...
That's
but
fine.
Still keep in touch. It's always nice to, you know, have someone message and say hi, and, you know, it would be nice. And if you have any issues that you would like to bring up upon, you know, council matters, I can tend to that as well.
Okay, wonderful. You can email also the show, bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook, BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space and you'll find the page. Be sure to like it if you haven't yet. Once again, thanks so much, Sherlena Rashid, Adil Johan. Sharing your knowledge, sharing your insights was truly fun. You've been listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.